Good morning. It is, what is today's date?
15th, May 8th.
Thank you. It's July 15th, 2020, at 8:00 a.m. This is a safety committee meeting in the city council chamber. And it is a couple minutes after 8 o'clock. Our topic today is, safety committee is focused on law enforcement policies. And present today, myself, Mary Westfall, and other safety committee members, Mark Fry, Brian McCann, and Lindsay Staff. Also joining us, Katie Capelini. And via Zoom, we have Doug Hainem and Patrick Richardson. From administration, we have Kevin Allen, Director of Safety, Chief Schnorr, Leslie Briney, and Chuck Silvernail is helping us with the Zoom connection. And also with us today is Mayor Stowe. So with that, I'd just like to make a few quick opening comments, and then we will really primarily be opening to questions from council members. First of all, I want to thank everybody for being here, and thankful to the other members of the council that are not on the safety that were able to join us today. This is certainly a very important time for us to be looking at safety-related issues. Lots has transpired since our last city council meeting, and we did feel like it was appropriate to take time to pause and to understand the issues facing law enforcement with regard to best practices and community safety. But it did seem appropriate to have a meeting prior to our next council meeting so that we could all make sure we have had an initial opportunity to ask questions. So we did take time now to consider the most pressing issues and what other communities are doing, and what other actions are being taken. So now that things have calmed down, we're glad to be together. I want to also start by congratulating Chief Schnorr and the Savannah Police Department on the certification from the Ohio Police Collaborative. Very happy for that, and I think Mayor Stowe did a great job of sharing with the community the success there with his mayor's message of June 25th. Also, I wanted to thank Chief Schnorr for his quick follow-up in getting emails out to city council members with the inclusive force policy and the recruitment and selection policies. Again, requested city council, very helpful for us to have that information in advance. All members of council, safety, as well as of the other members of council, weren't invited to submit questions in advance. Of course, we thank our superstar question asker, Mr. Mark Fry. He did a great job of getting us started and getting us to think a little more broadly about some of the things that we're facing. I have every confidence that he'll have additional questions today, and I'm grateful for that. I also would share with you that we did get some great information from Doug with regard to the President's Task Force and Campaign Zero, and then last night he sent some additional follow-up thoughts on the #8CampWait. So that's helpful. And then finally, I want to thank Kevin Aller and Chief Schnorr for forwarding out to everybody the copy of Governor DeWine and the Attorney General both plans for law enforcement reform. Again, all of this is helpful information. I think it really speaks to how important this issue is right now and all of the critical things that we need to be thinking about during these volatile times. Most importantly, I think I'd like to make it clear that the Savannah Police Department is really addressing these issues very carefully, looking at all of them, not that they have every single answer at every single moment. They're looking at best practices. They're considering changes that are forthcoming from the governor and looking at what other communities are doing. With that, I do want to open up the meeting. I'm going to start with Kevin Aller. One of the things I think would be helpful for our safety committee and council members to just be aware of is that Kevin does serve as Director of Safety. And in that capacity, Chief Schnorr does report into Kevin Aller, and it is his responsibility to oversee the police department in his capacity as Director of Safety. And it is something that is, again, another highly recommended platform for how a police department would interact, that they would have somebody in that Director of Safety role outside of their actual police department. So we're glad to see that our city, again, is employing the best practice there. So Kevin, with that, I'm going to open up and let you kind of get us launched.
Okay. Thank you, Mrs. Westfall. There have been, you know, several organizations such as the 8 Can't Wait, and there are a few others that have issued what they see as police reform measures that should be taken. And I think Governor DeWine, in his plan for law enforcement reform, did a pretty good job of addressing most of those concerns. They're not each and every one is addressed in those reform plans, but I think he's done a pretty good job of collecting them. The, you know, the items that are included in that plan, these were issued, this plan for reform was issued June 17th of this year. And the first part of that is a law enforcement oversight and accountability board, and that would be a state board, so really the cities in that wouldn't have much say in how that is structured or how it's run. We certainly have the opportunity to submit names for people to sit on it. But it would be a state board, so we wouldn't be overly involved. However, the concept of oversight is certainly welcome. Some of the things mentioned in the reforms is that, you know, if there is a problem individual out there that's a police officer, one city could address that by just saying we're going to terminate appointment and move on. City B has no idea what may have happened and why that officer was let go, what the circumstances were, and that kind of stuff. And unfortunately, we do a good job of background checks, so I don't think that would impact us. But that's not a good scenario. You know, it hasn't occurred in the police officer arena, but we've all read some unfortunate stories of school districts where that has occurred. You have people changing locations, and they bring a pretty troubled history with them. So this would help that, and eliminate that possibility, which obviously we're in favor of. Independent use of force investigations and prosecutions. An independent review is always welcome. The thing that we need to be a little careful on that is, you know, his language indicates qualified neutral agencies. Who's qualified and who's going to believe it's neutral? So that brings some you know, trouble, some possible trouble with it on how that's structured. And we'll wait and see how that gets. The legislation isn't final. This is just his plan, so we'll wait and see how the legislation actually comes out. He's going to basically make it mandatory that BCI handle any officer involved shooting and investigations. Again, they're most smaller, especially smaller police departments like our own. We don't have the personnel to really be able to appropriately investigate any kind of shooting. And so it was before my time. It was 2010, 2011, the last time the city had a shooting in town. And at that time, Chief Schnorr was involved with that, and we used BCI for that investigation back then. And it's our, it should we, knock on wood, I hope we never do, but should we have another one, it's our full intent to do that, regardless if this reform was in place or not. That's the proper thing to do. Use of force transparency, you know, all of the reports are public documents now. Anybody can come in and look at them anytime if they want to. His plan is to, for any time there is use of force, those reports be submitted to the Office of Criminal Justice Services so that data can be obtained. The records are there for in one location for the public to take a look at if they wish to, and we have no issue with that. We believe that would be a good thing. Chokeholds. The technique is not part of our training. We don't show officers how to do chokeholds. In fact, any type of neck restraint at all is against our policies. It's not permitted in our policies. We've all seen the police shows where, you know, somebody pops a, you know, supposedly pops a bunch of pills to get rid of the evidence, so to speak, and the officer grabs their throat and yells at them and spit it out and all that. that doesn't happen. Not in Salem. We just don't prevent it. So it's already not part of our program. We do prefer the language, we do like the language that the governor has proposed, that it puts a ban on chokeholds unless the officer or another's life is in danger. Because if we have an officer that's in a fight for his life, or a citizen's life, he needs to have the ability to do whatever he needs to do to make sure that he or the citizen goes home after this is all done. So we do like that language rather than all out ban. Body cameras, we're moving forward with that. In fact, we will be bringing authorization to purchase our body cameras to council at our next meeting on June 20th. We've moved ahead in that process and are ready to start implementing that. Advanced training, we're always in favor of training. Years ago, the state used to provide the funds for that additional training. The state mandated additional training. Luckily, or unluckily, depending on your perspective, they also mandated that the funding had to be provided by the state for that training. There's actually a rare funded mandate versus the unfunded funded mandates that we're used to. After about 2 or 3 years, the state quit providing funding, and so they've never pushed that mandated training because the funding hasn't been there. Now, from the city of Savannah standpoint, our annual budget, we currently budget $22,000 a year for training to send our officers. And that's a variety of training. Our SROs go, we do a de-escalation training. I'll let the chief get into that a little more because he knows the day-to-day training opportunities that we provide to the officers. Basic training, psychological exam, that's already required to become a police officer in the city of Savannah. We already do that and have done for quite a while. And then the Ohio Office of Law Enforcement Recruitment. The recent changes, part of the reason for the recent changes that council recently approved for us in being able to hire somebody that may not have that OPATA certification, we believe will help us to broaden our recruitment efforts and take a look at being able to diversify our department a little bit. The pool of individuals that we were getting was becoming smaller and smaller. Typically, police officers, once they get a job in a community, they're part of that community. They're really, most of them aren't really interested in moving and going to some other place. So we think the changes of being able to open up that pool will help us in that capacity and satisfies the goals that the governor has for that office that he plans on putting together. So those are the 8 or 9 main components of his reform that he's basing that on. And we think we're in pretty good standing with all of those issues already. There's certainly room, any place can improve, and we'll continue to work to improve. But that's where we stand. We believe there's a couple things that these reforms may not address specifically for the 8-camp weight agenda, some of those things. One of the things that I can think of the 8-camp weight is ban shooting at moving vehicles. And as a practice, we certainly don't train that. It's if somebody's fleeing a scene, we let them flee. We hope that we catch up to them. We have a no chase policy, so we hope we're able to keep up to them with our radio system and keep a track of where they're going. And if somebody's just fleeing the scene, we're certainly not going to, if somebody got a speeding ticket or they have a drug charge or something, we're not going to shoot it. However, if we have a vehicle at fault of us, that is coming in, and they're ramming the crowd all fast. Or they're going up and down the street, and in each house, they're firing AK-47s out the window or whatever. They're not gonna stop. And to ban the ability to shoot at a moving vehicle, I think our officers are gonna have a difficult time just standing by and saying, oh, I can't do anything because I'm not able to shoot at the shooting car. So, an all-out ban, the police world and the police call world just isn't black and white. It's just not this or that. Because you don't know what the suspect or the situation that you're responding to is gonna bring for you. And so there are times where it just may be necessary to do it. Sylvania Township had a recent incident, unfortunately, and that's, that investigation obviously isn't done, but, the suspect is alleged to have been, driving the car right at the officer and slamming him between the car door and the car. That officer has a right to defend his life. And so those kinds of situations may call for it. But certainly not, like I said, if somebody's making the scene, we'll catch them another day, hopefully. Those are a few of our concerns. We just don't deal with those kinds of incidents on a routine basis. So, I believe we sent all of the policies that was requested. I apologize to Mr. Fry. I don't know why that 303 wasn't in there. It was in the information that the chief sent. I evidently didn't get it drug over to the to the original email, but I believe we provided all the policies that are requested. And I think I'll just kind of leave it there. If that's our answer. If somebody has questions, we're more than happy to answer them. I appreciate the comments from Mrs. Westfall. Our police officers do a fantastic job of de-escalating situations. We just don't have high numbers of use of force or complaints or anything like that that you might find in other locations. And that's a credit to the people that we have on the street, being able to talk that individual down to a level where we can get things calm and talk about what needs to happen from that point on. So they're great people. They've had a rough couple months. They continue to handle it with class every day. So,
thank you very much, Kevin. That was very helpful. I do think we all recognize that we are fortunate to have strong leadership and a strong police force. And certainly, we have been fortunate to be in a community that has not had to, at this point in time, deal with a lot of these most aggressive situations. But I do think it's helpful for us to understand that we're prepared. And I do have confidence we're prepared. With that, I do just want to open to questions. I'm going to start with questions from the safety committee members, and then certainly all council members will have a chance to ask questions. So, any specific questions from safety committee members?
Mr. Allen, I have a question. One of the things you mentioned was that officers have the right to defend their lives. And that chokeholds, I think specifically, or any sort of neutralizing techniques like that might be used in a situation in which their or someone else's life is in danger. And I'd like to know a little bit more about what the decision-making process is, or sort of the training of how you know that you've crossed into that life-threatening situation versus because I know a lot of us would be being mentally prepared for things and seeing things from a single perspective. It's very difficult to keep an eye on the whole situation. And so and I'm sorry if I missed that in the generous amounts of information you gave us regarding the subject. But I'm curious about knowing a little bit more about how that determination is made from not being life-threatening to then switching over.
I think that's where you get into where police business isn't a black and white business. It's that line, that gray line is going to move, you know, on several different calls. If the individual has attacked you and is, you know, aggressively trying to harm you, the potential is there. He only has to grab one thing, and your life is gone. They have a right, in my opinion, they have a right to defend themselves to make sure that doesn't happen. It's not like a wrestling match, or when you see fights at home where all of a sudden somebody says, okay, I give. If they're in that situation, that individual is going to fight. And he's going to fight because he wants to get away. There's a reason he or she wants to get away. And if the officer can't get them subdued so that they're going to continue to fight, there's going to come a time where he's got to, in some manner or other, he has to protect his life to make sure that he goes home. Hopefully, in that meantime, we've got some other officers arrive and that he'll have some assistance and he'll get to that point. But, you know, if he has grabbed the officer's gun, but our officer is fortunate enough to be able to get this back, that's an incident where, you know, I believe that, you know, it's warranted for the officer to be able to do whatever he has to do to get that individual secured. I don't think there's not a list of, if the suspect does this, then you can. If the suspect does this, then you can. There are so many things that the suspect can do in order to make sure that officer goes home, he's going to have to. I can assure you, that's the officer's last response. I mean, he doesn't want to be. Officers get into this profession to protect people and to make sure that our citizens go home every day. Having to go to that step of taking a life, that is the last resort any officer wants to take. So I think some of the things that you've seen, the incident that has unfortunately stimulated a lot of the recent protests, that officer's life wasn't at risk. He's going to have to face that. But there are times when I think the officers are warranted. I don't think that there's a definition that you can put to it.
Okay. Any other questions?
Okay. I guess it's up to me then.
Can I get my coffee?
Yeah, go ahead. So, first of all, I want to echo Mrs. Muswell's comments. Even in typical times, being a police officer is a very difficult job at best, and incredibly difficult oftentimes. In the last 4 months, it's gotten much, much more challenging for obvious reasons. So I want to applaud the police department and the administration and yourself, Mr. Allen, for the way things have been handled over the years and obviously most recently. You mentioned the $22,000 training budget. So let me ask you a question about that. When we're allocating training dollars, is that like we're sending Officer A to Columbus for training and we're just paying $495 for the day for the training, or is that we're allocating the time that we're, the hourly rate that we're spending on the officer for that one day's worth of training as well? Is it both, or is it just the $495 for the course?
Just the $495. The labor costs just come off.
That's already some cost. Okay, yeah. So what's been the history of our training as far as, because I know I've been on council for a number of years, but I don't recall the specifics Have we had a consistent number with training? In your thought process, you mentioned that training, you know, there's always an opportunity for more training. How is, in your thought process, is that something that we're okay on, and we've been okay, and do we need to modify it given current circumstances?
Boyer, you, Keenan, did you get to him and send him a pitch before?
No, not at all.
Actually, prior to this year, it's actually a good question. I'm glad you asked so that I can address it. Prior to this year, really for as long as I can remember, I didn't go back and check the actual budgets, but we had been in the $15,000 to $17,000 a year range. And one of the things when Chief Starr came in is I'd really like to increase that and be able to take advantage of additional opportunities. Just this year, we increased that from $17,000 to $22,000. Now, could there be increases in the future? There could be. We'll see what we can get accomplished with this 22 and see if we need any adjustments. One of the things that our department does very well is, you know, we send people to, train the trainer type training. So they go learn a little bit more about a certain subject, learn how to teach it and train other people on it, and then they bring it back into this room and train the rest of our department. So we're very good in leveraging those training funds, if you will. And being able to get the whole department trained and only really need to pay for one or two officers to go someplace for it.
Obviously, with everything with COVID going on, this may not be a typical conversation, but I'm going to ask a question anyway. For the $5,000, what do you anticipate, what does the department anticipate utilizing that $5,000 for? What type of additional training are we? Were we going to put forward to the $5,000?
I think one of the things, and Chief, if I say anything out of turn or out of place, feel free to correct me, but you know, a couple of things that the Chief is concerned about is, and Flyer Hospital really brought it to an even greater extent, is the mental health issue that's going on. Our officers respond to a lot of calls that are more mental health versus your typical crime, thoughts of crime. And that de-escalation technique, the Chief has, and our captains, really stressed the de-escalation techniques to keep things at a civil level rather than all of the screaming matches that you kind of see on TV and that kind of stuff. And, so I know that they really concentrated on those issues. A couple of years ago, school safety was the issue in that, so we kind of kicked up some training in those areas. So it kind of varies a little bit, but I think that the Chief's main interest right now is to continue to try to be able to manage those mental health calls.
How many of those types of interactions do we typically get now? I know it's a lot, but I don't know. Is it 5 a month? Is it 25 a month? Just trying to get a sense.
Well, it's much closer to 25. It's probably more than 25 a month.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a routine part of our department.
Is it safe to say that those are some of the most relevant situations the officers encounter?
They can be. Okay. They can be. But again, those de-escalation techniques that they learn enable us to keep those at a civil level. The Chief's going to come up. He's going to explain the program that he's kind of been using with those mental health. I want him to do that because he's really kind of spearheaded that with the township. They do a very good job of. We get some people that are trained more in the medical side of the mental health issue, and then we have the police there for the safety factor. And that's all I'm going to say about it. I'm going to let them take it from there.
I'll ask the chief then about the other pieces of that.
Yeah, he's more, the day-to-day, he's more, so, yeah.
So, do you have a sense, I know I asked the chief this briefly, so you'd have some time to think about it prior to the meeting. Do you have a sense of how many community interactions we have between our police department and the community? And I'm talking about official interactions, on a monthly or annual basis?
Any type of interaction, or?
Well, I'm not talking about, you know, the school safety officers seeing the kids walking down the hallway, saying hi to them.
Okay.
I'm talking about more official types of interactions.
Yeah, that I don't know. I can only imagine what the number would be. It was, actually, when I was driving in this morning, I was like, oh, I wish I had my camera out. I was coming past Northview High School, and there was a group of kids out there waiting for, weight training or something, right? And they were apparently football players. And there's one of our officers in the parking lot throwing the football back and forth with the kids. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that our officers, you know, I think you've seen on our Facebook site, you know, an officer was driving through a neighborhood and he stopped and started shooting baskets towards a couple of kids. Those are the types of interactions that we really love to have. Because it puts people in that our officers are friends and someone that they can rely on. For a number of interactions, I'll see if the chief can, when he comes up, and we'll do that, so.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm just trying to get a sense of that.
Sure.
We talked about, at the last council meeting, the election poll policy. Are we still on schedule for that? I know there's a lot of things going on in everybody's day. Are we still on schedule for kind of a fall completion of that? Is that what we're looking at?
We're still shooting for that. We've gotten what we believe to be the big policies, especially with everything that's going on right now, the use of force policies and those kinds of things. We've gotten those taken care of pretty well. There may be some small edits, but those are pretty well locked in. Some of our other policies of, you know, roll call requirements and things like that, you know, those will be stretching out. We're hoping to have that completed by fall. It'll depend on how kind of COVID and all of that is the rest of the year, so.
That's always a joker in the deck, right?
Yeah.
So, you've mentioned the background checks that we do prior to hiring an officer. Because I noticed in my time on council that we oftentimes hire officers from other agencies. Do we get access to their personnel records from those departments? Is that so? We do get access to those.
Yeah,
that's standard operating procedure for us.
Our officers go, or our department, some cases we have to go to the other department reporting the final hire. We have to go and look at the file on their site, because obviously they don't want that floating around. It depends on what's in that file, because some of the bargaining unit contracts or some of the other cities and villages have different policies as to how long they're going to keep a certain event in a personnel file versus, you know, some other city file.
Right.
So, you know, we're somewhat dependent on what's in that file. Mm-hmm. And that's the part of the governance reform that I like, is that, you know, all of that information is supposed to be conveyed. So it's not put away in some other file or some other situation where the person, you don't know what happened with that individual. So.
Okay, great. So I'm going to ask now some of the tough questions, or I think they're tough questions, maybe they're not. On the one response that you sent me earlier this week, where you said we had received one complaint, where it says of the 55 applications obtained, you know, did we receive any complaints? And you said we received one. Internal affairs or administrative review. Was that an IA investigation or an administrative review, or is there no difference? I mean, as we have such a small department, I'm not sure if there's a difference.
Yeah, there's not. There's a bit of a difference in that the administration, the supervisor, which could be in the past, has been a sergeant. Now it's required, I think, that you address that in a future question where the chief has to sign off on any, resolution. In the past, it's been a sergeant or possibly a captain that did the administrative review. And I, an internal investigation is when it goes to more, it goes in depth, more a more in depth investigation, and it may have more bodies involved in trying to decipher what happened to that. We had in my time here. It was one of our detective bureau sergeants that would conduct the internal investigation. But again, we've only, in my time here, we've only had one or two. It's kind of a difficult thing because we just don't have them. We have a good enough department that we don't have to go to that step.
Right. So. And we're all appreciative of that,
certainly.
The conversation or the questions, I know that I'm being an engineer, and this is a polar opposite yes or no kind of thing for me, and I apologize for that up front, because I'm sure, I know it's not at some level, but at another level, my personality is what it is. So I'm going to ask some additional questions about the techniques, because to me, a technique is a specific thing. It's learning how to tie your shoes. There's techniques to do that. There are specific things you need to do, A, B, C, D, and E. And the training for those techniques, that's part of the thing that I'm still not wrapping my head around when you're saying that there's techniques that are taught, but they're not specific, where there's no, I'm still not understanding that piece of it. So if you could clarify that a little bit for me, that would be great.
I'm going to try to do it in more in land. Again, I'm an engineer. I'm going to try to do it more in layman's terms, and then if the chief wants to follow up with anything, that's fine. But I look at it, and I didn't ask this question specifically of the chief, but I look at it as, they're trained more. I look at it more as advanced self-defense training, if you will. They're trained more that if an individual comes at you, how are you going to, one, avoid the attack, and two, subdue the attack? And so it's, to say if a guy swings at you, you do A. If a guy tries to take you down, you do B. I think they're more trained on techniques on how to level the situation so that we can get to the talking level versus the physical level. So that's how I look at it. The chief can certainly add to that more so than what I would be able to address properly, I think.
Okay. So in the one you pointed to, the 303 that you sent over, thank you very much for that. So what are the control devices? Because I was reading through this policy, this draft policy. What are the control devices that a SPD officer typically has on their person day to day?
All that we have now, we have some smaller items. It used to be that you carry the stick, you have, of course, your gun, handcuffs, things of that nature. Really, the primary item today is the taser. It's a non-lethal equalizer. I don't know that any of our officers even carry sticks anymore. Because it's just, it's not nearly as effective as a taser. The chief can answer if there's any more, but that's the primary piece of equipment that they use now.
Okay.
The question was some of the equipment that our officers carry. I said it used to be the stick of the top.
Right.
But not the primary thing is the taser.
Yeah, it really, the policy 303 talks about
So the absolutes, as far as, you know, techniques versus training, your absolutes are going to be with your weapon systems. You know, your less lethal systems like taser, OC spray, or what people would call mace, the baton usage, and obviously firearms. So, and even handcuffs, because handcuffs are used in force as well. So, you know, there are absolutes or rules of engagement with those tools, if you will. The training aspect, as far as self-defense, is varied and is constantly changing. And probably the biggest change I noticed in my career is the popularity of MMA. Okay, so a lot of individuals, professionally or you know, on the street, as we would call it, train in MMA ground fighting techniques. So we made, there was a big shift in that law enforcement to learn ground fighting techniques and ground fighting defenses. That being said, we have to train the officers on techniques that they can do, and every officer is different. There are things that I can do that my reach is a little bit longer than some of the other officers, so I might be more of a striker or you know, a person who uses throws. You know, if a person comes at me, I would be tempted to try to throw them than to do a takedown. A person who's shorter and maybe more stocky would have a difference. So our defensive tactics instructors, and we have three now on the department. One is we're very fortunate to have Officer John Pinkstaff. He's one of the top self-defense instructors in this part of the state. They train the officers in a variety of ways to defend themselves if they're faced with a threat. Is there a specific list that every officer uses? No, because it really depends on your body type and your skill set on how you can defend yourself. What the officer has to do is keep their actions objectively reasonable for the situation that they're facing. So, and that's the, you know, when we go over that training, the first thing that is addressed every training session is the policy and procedure of how you, you know, defend yourself or how you effect an arrest, and the amount of force that you're allowed to use to control the situation. And then, like with the absolutes that we might be talking about, as far as you shall and you can do this, are typically related to the weapon systems, you know, that we employ in the course of our duties.
So, Mr. Craig, could I just ask a question?
You know, we are coming up at 9 o'clock hours. I just want to take the temperature of the group in terms of ability to stay beyond that. Do people have the capacity to stay until 9:15? Mr. Hayden and Mr. Richardson, could you hang on a little bit longer beyond that 9 o'clock hour?
Yes.
Okay. So I think what we'll do is drive just to try and wrap up by 9:15, and we may need another meeting, but I do just wanted to make sure we're all on the same page there.
I appreciate that. The only thing that I would comment on then, and maybe this is overkill on my reading of the language, but that's part of the things that I do. I don't know if that's a policy, whether the flexibility that you're talking about, Chief, which makes sense to me when you say it to me, that's not what I perceive being reflected in the document. I just want to make sure that since what's reflected in the policy is actually what we're doing and vice versa.
Right, and it all comes back, really, to the Supreme Court decision, Graham v. Conner, which talks about the use of force and what's objectively reasonable.
Okay.
And again, we have to caution ourselves not to try to have specific scenarios and specific, you know, if-then statements for officers, because the threats that we face as a public, that we face as a community, and that we face as officers are constantly changing. You know, a year ago, we were really talking about school shootings and why aren't the police doing more about that? So whatever social problem comes down the pike, and especially if it relates to safety, it's somehow, you know, involves the police. And so that's why you don't see a lot of the, you know, specific, if you face this scenario, you must do this, because it's too dynamic for that.
And I understand there's infinite number of variables, and there are always, as you say, shifting and changing. That's why I was making that suggestion that maybe there's different wording that we could put in there to allow for, because there's not a lot of specifics, but the wording that's in there now is more specific than what I hear. You know, it sounds like the operations are actually going forward with. Just a couple of, and these are silly questions, I'm sure, so I apologize. Kinetic energy projectile guidelines. I'm assuming that's bean bags and rubber bullets, but I don't know that.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay.
I was trying to think of anything else, but yes.
Let's see, what else? I think that's it. I do have a couple of additional questions for the chief when he comes up, but I'm fine now. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Pratt. Mr. Allen, do you think it would be appropriate to have the chief share his comments, or would you prefer questions from the other council members first? I'd like to make sure we give them an opportunity.
It's the committee's wishes.
I'll open it up to questions from the other members of council, because I want to make sure I'm respectful of their time today as well. And so with that, I would invite if any of our other members of council that are present have additional questions, and if safety committee members have additional questions, please feel free to ask. Katie.
So thank you for sharing all of this information, and I mean, I really think you guys are doing an amazing job. I mean, I don't have anything like as detailed and intense as Mr. Fry asked, but just I feel like I have to ask, and like it's across the country, people are reimagining their police department. And we did say that most of our calls are mental health related and social issues, and the last shooting was in 2010. I'm just wondering, as we go down the line, I'm not even expecting an answer right now, does everyone on our force need a badge and a gun? I mean, as we're looking at the problems that we have, maybe we need to reimagine even how we're building a force just going forward. And that's really all I have to say. It's just something to think about in the long term.
Sure, and that's going to be part of this ongoing discussion for police reform. So it's something that will certainly, it's worthy of discussion, and we'll see where, as you said, where that future takes us.
Thank you. No question. Anyone else?
Listening to Kevin's presentation, and let me start by saying that during my time on council, I have never received a complaint about our policing. And while obviously, the fact that I haven't received a complaint doesn't mean that there's never been a problem. If there has been, it hasn't been brought to mind. But listening to Kevin's representation about what we do as a police force, it is all very good, but it is not reflected in this policy 300. The policy itself does not suggest that we require the things that Kevin has represented that we do, and is not consistent with the items that the government's task force that we reviewed the aim for law enforcement reform piece. Many of those things are not reflected in policy 300 presently. So I guess the first question I have is policy 300 actively being redrafted at a state level or at some other level?
Yeah, I would say that it's actively under review, Doug. One of the things that has been talked about is there were some proposed changes and some language changes that certain groups wanted to see. But then when the governor came out with his plan for reform and indicated that he was looking to get legislation passed with those, Everybody kind of slowed down because they wanted to see what those language changes were going to be to make sure that any language changes in the policy adheres to that. So rather than change it one time and then have to change it again, We're waiting to see what that legislation is actually going to say.
Say your last one.
Doug?
We lost.
Yeah, I'm not sure, we lost you for a little bit there, so.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, I'm not quite sure how best to proceed here. I didn't know we were having this meeting until late last week. I didn't actually receive the notice of it until Monday. But I'm going to provide council with, a markup of the policy that I think, we ought to, there are a number of places in here where we use the word should, where I think we need to use the word shall. I think there are other places where we could have, clearer statements of our, preference, for how we use the board. And frankly, one of my concerns is that, this policy, as I read it, is, clearly drafted by lawyers with the idea of, defending, police action in, civil suits. And, that's fine. Nobody understands that better than I, except maybe Mosley. But the fact is that there are the provisions that, that we can't wait are talking about are not reflected in the policy. And the way that we do police and Kevin, which you represented here in the morning, is not reflected in this policy. So, I will endeavor in the, coming days or weeks, to hear with council specifically, the language that I think, will bring this policy more in line with the representations present of how you indicate we do things, than is presently reflected in the language of policy. And then we can figure out how to go forward from there. I think that will provide a sound basis for us to have additional discussions going forward, as opposed to me trying to discuss that it here in a, when we have a limited amount of time.
Sounds good.
Doug, I think that would be very helpful, and I do think as we look at those things, it gives certainly our leadership a chance to take a look at your thoughts and council to take a look at your thoughts, and then to also take into consideration the best practices that are outlined from the collaborative that we just got our approval from, as well as from the government's guidelines. So I think that would be a nice full circle of how we consider all things. Anything else from any other council members? Okay, I think that you have some thoughts that perhaps you felt Chief Schnorr could share. Is that still relevant?
Thank you. Well, I'm not sure exactly where we left off, but just in a general sense, I know one of the questions that was asked earlier was about the contacts, and so as far as official contacts, we track those by calls for service, so the times that officers were actually either dispatched or called out with someone, and that ranges from about 16,000 to about 18,000 calls for service per year, so total calls for service. Now,
Chief, did you say 15 to?
16 to 18,000, you know, if you look at it tracked over the last 5 or so years. That's about where we fall. I will say we are conservative on how we count those numbers. Some agencies count every vehicle or individual that shows up at a call. We don't do that. That's just a true number of the actual contact. If another officer shows up, it's not another call for service. Some agencies do that. There's different theories about how to count those numbers, but but we tend to be very conservative on that.
Thank you.
In a general statement, obviously, many of these things that we've been talking about were already in the process of being updated, the way we handle complaints, the way we handle, the update of our policy procedures, the involvement with the Ohio Collaborative, those were all goals that I had when I took over this job a little over a year ago. It is ironic that they've come to light right now with everything that's going on in the country. At the same time, some of those, some of these things that are out there in the media and public, popular opinion, don't always match up with the realities of what the job entails. Specifically, when you look at some of the requests by some of the 8-camp wait, or the, there's another one called 21st Century, something or other, some of those absolutes just don't fit with the reality of the challenge the community faces. And you can see this playing out across the country. And from my perspective, we want to make sure that we're providing legal, just services at the same time that we're protecting our community and protecting our employees. So, but from that standpoint, I guess, what are other specific questions you have? I know you talked about use of force things. Were there any other specific questions that you wanted me to address in the few minutes we have left?
Mrs. Westwell, if I kind of don't want to...
Absolutely. Okay. I do think you were clear, Mr. Fry, that you had some specific questions for Chief Schnorr, and I think the group would benefit from hearing them.
Well, Chief, as you know, from personal conversations, I have a special needs daughter. So that's one of my questions, because a lot of individuals who have special needs have a dual diagnosis with mental health challenges. And you'd indicated some additional training in that regard this year, and I applaud that. I think that's wonderful. One of the questions that I would have for you is, some individuals with special needs, you can recognize, a person, an officer can recognize immediately. Others cannot. And sometimes those individuals can't necessarily always respond in the typical way that most of us would respond. So how does that, those compliance techniques that you referred to in the policies, interact with those mental health and special needs individuals in our community? Because there are a reasonably significant number of those individuals, and some of which may be encountered from time to time by the officers.
Well, it's really two separate kind of, types of training. And one of the things I'm very proud of that we've done, and it really hasn't been talked about, but every officer that works for the Hispanic Police Department is also a certified crisis intervention officer. So the Lucas County Mental Health Board offers a training. It's a 40-hour specialized training for, and they call it the CIT, Crisis Intervention Team. And about 40 years ago, when I was the training captain, I thought it was important that all of our officers be certified, even though many departments have a handful of officers that are certified. If that officer happens to be working, they try to send an officer to those types of calls. And in Toledo, it's really very popular that when people call them, they'll ask for a CIT officer. Well, every civilian officer is a CIT officer. So when an officer approaches that scene, if the person isn't attacking someone, if the individual that they're dealing with isn't attacking someone or actively acting out with a weapon, the officer's going to approach that situation and try to triage what is a specific issue. And part of the CIT training is recognizing people with conditions or disabilities or a mental health crisis, and trying to align that situation with the right type of service. And the other part is that the thing that we've done that's different than a lot of the other agencies is that we have an active partnership with the fire department on these types of calls. And officers are encouraged to, early on in the incident, bring in fire services and work on that issue together. And many times that person with special needs, whether it's a child who has a condition or is an adult who's in crisis, many times that person is transported to the hospital by EMS and not by police officers, because it's just, a police car is not a good environment for a person who's actively, acting out in crisis. They're going to injure themselves. It's a very confined space. So we've had success working with the fire department. We continue that partnership. I just had a conversation with Chief Ram in the last 3 weeks about
you know, our level of commitment to that, and they're still steadfast in that, that commitment, so.
And the only other question I had for you, was in regards to the interactions that you had mentioned. So 16 to 18,000 a year, and we have less than a handful of complaints on an annualized basis. Is there something, you know, you'd mentioned in the thing that we had four so far this year, but that you modified the structure. What were some of those other complaints? I mean, I don't want to obviously go inside the department, but was there something specific that you think caused four? Was it change in sensitivity in our community, or what drove the, you know, up to four from one or two a year?
Well, there's a lot going on in 2020, as you may have noticed.
Absolutely, that's why I asked the question.
Right. A couple of issues. The first issue is, as we made these changes in this transition policy, I made the decision to update our policies and become part of the collaborative. Part of the collaborative is an enhanced policy on complaints. Prior to that, we had a complaint policy. It was all part of our IA internal affairs policy. And really, the only complaints that ultimately were reported were a complaint that rise to the level of an internal affairs investigation. Today, with our new policy and in the interest of transparency, and then actually back in January is when I started doing this, anytime somebody calls in or sends in a letter or stops in and lodges some type of complaint about our services, it's documented. So it's documented on complaint form. And that's why you are seeing a little bit higher number there compared to maybe the last few years as four versus two or one. Because we do document those. And this year so far, two of the complaints were about people wanting to do different things with their cars after an accident. You know, on Monroe Street, Alexis Road, on US 23, if a car is involved in an accident, it's disabled or not functional, we automatically call police tow because there's an interest to get that car off the street so somebody else doesn't run into it. In two situations, people were not happy with that. They wanted to make their own arrangements or call AAA. We can't do that. If you're going to wait for an hour and there's a car sitting at, you know, Monroe and Alexis, it's just not going to work. And when we work through those things and try to explain them, the one individual just was not happy. Just was once, you know, does not like our procedures. There's really nothing I can do about that. You know, but we still handle his complaint, still looked into, still reviewed. And then some of the other times, it's a difference of opinion. You know, the officers have a job to do, and a citizen may or may not like the way that it was handled or talked about or whatever. But we do have one that we're actively looking at right now. But all the complaints that we've had this year, we'd be considered a minor complaint, where it wasn't a civil rights violation, it wasn't use of force or anything like that. It was basically somebody who just didn't like the way we had to do our job. So far this year, none of those cases have risen to the level of an internal affairs investigation. They've all been what we call an administrative review, where someone's filed a complaint, and either a supervisor or a captain is reviewing that situation to see if we're within policy or not. And, you know, that kind of leads us into, when we talked about administrative review versus internal affairs investigation. So, use of force is a perfect example. Every use of force is documented in the use of force report, which is separate than a police report. It specifically categorizes all the types of the weapon systems or the circumstances that were involved in that incident. And that is, every one of those cases is reviewed by the training captain. The training captain looks to make sure, even if there's no complaint, there's no injury, anything like that, to make sure the officer's use of force was appropriate with policy. An internal affairs investigation, conversely, is a situation where a complaint was lodged by a member of the public or a member of the police department, or during that administrative review, the administrator is reviewing that, and those are ultimately signed off by myself, sees an egregious incident where the officer was outside of policy and needs a formal investigation. When internal affairs investigations are different in the fact that typically the union is involved because the officer is going to be brought in for formal questioning, and their career could be affected by a written reprimand, suspension, or possibly termination. So the stakes are much higher than internal affairs investigation versus administrative review. May or may not be any problem. It's just a formal
look at that incident because it rose to the level of use of force.
Thank you, Chief.
Certainly.
All I have is, well, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Fry. We do have 5 minutes. I don't know, Mr. Richardson, you're kind of quiet today. Anything on your radar?
I don't have any other questions. You guys hear me?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
I'm good. I'm taking notes. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Well, there is no formal action to be taken today. At this point, I think we'll continue to monitor policies, changes in policies from agencies who are certifying agencies of sort, of appropriate sort, as well as from the governor's law enforcement reform. And in addition to that, we'll look forward to getting Mr. Hayden's thoughts. And I think with that, I would certainly anticipate that we would have a follow-up meeting at an appropriate time that's needed. So with that, I would ask if there's a motion to adjourn the Safety Committee meeting.
So moved.
Second.
And moved and seconded that we adjourn the Safety Committee meeting at 9:10. All in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carried, and this meeting stands adjourned. Thank you so very much.